hall, both down below and up in the gallery, as you can all see, is completely full. Therefore, anybody now arriving should please go over to the new theatre, which is just across the way, where there is a video overflow meeting going on. Okay? Memorial Prize to this lecture by Eric Hobsbawm, who is the winner of the prize this year for his book, The Age of Extremes, The Short History of the 20th Century, 1914 to 1991. I must say also, we are very sorry to learn that certain journals put the wrong time for this meeting, and we do apologise for any inconvenience of people who came earlier. Now, just a word very briefly about the Isaac Deutscher Memorial Prize. This was instituted after the death of Isaac Deutscher in 1967, he was recognized as a great socialist historian and a teacher who we thought provided a unique link between a rich Marxist tradition and new generations of socialists in many countries. And this prize is awarded every year, and the winner of the prize is invited to give a lecture the following year, normally at the LSE, to whom we are grateful this year once again for accommodating us. I want, before we go on to Eric's lecture, to announce the winner of the 1996 prize, and that is Donald Sassoon for his book 100 Years of Socialism, The West European Left in the 20th Century. Many of you here are already acquainted with Eric Hobsbawm's Age of Extremes, which completes his four-volume history of the world since 1789. One reviewer has described it as the book of the decade, which will be read in future times as an autobiography of the 20th century, not perhaps the only one, but probably the most comprehensive and the best written. It does indeed, in our view, represent a remarkable synthesis of political, economic, social, and cultural history, written not only as an outstanding historian, but also as a lifelong socialist participant. It has received wide international recognition and prizes not only here but elsewhere, including, I understand from Eric, having been awarded a prize in the major literary prize in Canada, just pipping at the post, the memoirs of McNamara. It has also been translated into a great many languages, including recently Albanian and Moldovan. Although, as I say, there have been other prizes, we think that it's particularly appropriate that he should receive the Deutscher Prize, which is designed to be awarded for a work which exemplifies the best and most innovative writing in or about the Marxist tradition. And I think there is no question whatsoever but that the Age of Extremes richly meets that criterion. Now, a major theme in Age of Extremes is, of course, the Russian October Revolution with its profound repercussions on world history. And indeed, Eric has chosen as his subject of the lecture, Can We Write the History of the Russian Revolution? And therefore, without further ado, I hand over to Eric.
I knew Isaac Deutscher, I admired him, and it's therefore extremely nice to get the Deutscher Prize. I've chosen my subject as a tribute to Isaac Deutscher, whose most lasting work, I think, is a classic in the history of the Russian Revolution, namely his life of Trotsky. So, the immediate answer to the title of my lecture is, obviously, yes, it can be written. But this still leaves open the wider question: can we ever write the definitive history of anything? Not just history as seen today, or as seen in 1945, as seen from a particular class or local or other point of view, including, of course, the history of the Russian Revolution. Here, in an equally obvious sense, the answer is no, in spite of the fact that, in my view, there is an objective historical reality which historians investigate in order to establish, among other things, the difference between fact and fiction. You are free to imagine that Elvis Presley is still alive, but it ain't so. And any history which does not recognize the basic difference between what was so and what wasn't so is not worth it. Still, every generation asks its particular new questions about the past, and they go on doing so. And remember, in the history of the modern world, we are dealing with an almost infinite accumulation of public and private records. There's no way of even guessing what future historians will look for and find in these records that we haven't thought of. The French Revolutionary Archives have kept historians busy for 200 years, and there's no sign of a diminishing return. We've only just started on the Himalayas of documentation in the Soviet archives. So, for no other reason, a definitive history is certainly not possible at present. And yet, history as a serious activity is possible, because historians can agree about what they're talking about, what questions they're discussing, and even on enough of the answers to narrow down their differences sufficiently for meaningful discussion. In the field of 20th century Russian history, this has long been almost impossible. Now, the end of the Soviet Union has inevitably changed the way all historians see the Russian Revolution, because they are now able to see it, in fact, they're obliged to see it, in a different perspective, like a biographer of a subject who has died compared to a biographer of somebody whose subject is still alive. Of course, it's patent that it will take a long time before the passions of those who write the history of the USSR will have cooled down to the tepid temperature of those who nowadays write about the history of the Protestant Reformation, let's say, which used to be a matter of great bitterness between Catholics and Protestant scholars. It is now possible to write the history of the 1688 revolution in Great Britain as though it doesn't matter greatly to us, unless you happen to be in Martin McGuinness's dairy or in the Reverend Ian Paisley's Bushmills, which is the home of what was once described to me by an ideological Irish drinker as a Protestant whiskey. In the former USSR and in the successors to the socialist states, the history of the Russian Revolution is still being written in this spirit, which is why nothing except new source materials for history, but not good history, is likely to come out of there for a very long time. But even outside, most of us are still too close in emotion and partiality to see the Cold War between capitalism and communism. I say the Cold War because in actual fact there never was a hot war between capitalism and socialism. Capitalist countries had wars with each other, and so did socialist countries, but not a major confrontation on the field of battle between the United States and the USSR. Anyway, we're too close to this to see the Cold War as we can see, let's say, the 30 Years' War, which was also a war of faith and a war of passion and a war of conviction. There's another thing. We can make a judgment of the revolution which started the USSR, but not yet of its end. And this will certainly affect historical judgment. The catastrophe in which the common people of the old USSR have been plunged by the end of the old system is not yet at an end. I suggest that the sudden revolutionary leap from the old system to capitalism, which has been imposed on them, has disrupted the economy more than World War II did, probably more than the October Revolution, and it will take far longer to recover from it. Nevertheless, we can now begin to ask, on what can historians of the Russian Revolution legitimately agree today? Can we reach a consensus on some questions in the history of the Russian Revolution which need to be asked, and on some elements in it which can be firmly established by the rules of research and evidence, and therefore beyond can be established beyond serious dispute? One problem is that the most difficult of such questions lie beyond the usual range of historical proof and disproof, because they are about might-have-beens. Much of what actually happened can now be known because information is available, although during practically the whole life of the USSR, much of it was inaccessible, hidden behind locked archive doors and barricades of official lies and half-truth. This is why the enormous mass of the literature that appeared during that time will have to be an enormous mass, will have to be junked, whatever its ingenuity in using fragmentary sources and the plausibility of its guesswork. We just won't need it anymore. For instance, Robert Conquest's The Great Terror will drop out of sight as a major treatment of its subject simply because the archival sources are now available. Bob Davis recently in an article has demonstrated that these sources are there and are at variance with what Conquest says, but that's not the important thing. They are there and they are the primary sources now. Conquest will be read, if at all, as a pioneer effort to assess the Stalin terror, but one which has become obsolete as a treatment of the terrible facts it tried to investigate. When better or more complete data are available, they must take the place of poor and incomplete ones. For instance, if it turns out, as Davis shows, that not 50% of the officers of the Red Army were removed from the service during the terror, as was once supposed, but 15%, arguments based on the first figure must fall to the ground. And if the archives were to show, which is perfectly possible, that the figures for something are much larger than the ones that have previously been supposed, the same is true. This alone will transform the historiography of the Soviet era, although it won't answer all our questions, particularly during the early Soviet period before the full bureaucratization or institutionalization of the system when the Soviet government and party actually didn't know very much about what was going on over a lot of its territory. On the other hand, the most burning debates about 20th century Russian history have not been about what happened, but about what might have happened. Here are some. Was a Russian revolution inevitable? Could Tsarism have saved itself? Was Russia on the way to a liberal capitalist regime in 1913? Once a revolution had occurred, we have an even more explosive set of what we historians call counterfactuals. What if Lenin hadn't got back to Russia? Could the October Revolution have been avoided? What would have happened in Russia if it had been avoided? More to the point of Marxist discussion, what made the Bolsheviks decide to take power with an obviously unrealistic program of socialist revolution in Russia at that time? Should they have taken power? What if the European Revolution, that's to say the German Revolution on which they put their money, had taken place? Could the Bolsheviks have lost the Civil War? But for the Civil War, how would the Bolshevik Party and Soviet policy have developed? Having won the Civil War, were there alternatives to the U-turn by which they abandoned the war communism and went in for the new economic policy, i.e. a kind of market development for a few years? What might have happened if Lenin had continued in full action? The list is endless, and I've merely mentioned some of the obvious counterfactual questions of the period up to Lenin's death. Now, the object of my lecture isn't to give my answers to these questions, but to try and put such questions into perspective of a working historian. They can't be answered on the basis of evidence about what happened, because they are about what did not happen. For instance, we can say, beyond serious doubt, that in the autumn of 1917, an enormous wave of popular radicalization, of which the Bolsheviks were the main beneficiaries, swept the provisional government aside, so that by the time the October Revolution took place, power didn't so much have to be seized as picked up from where it had been dropped. Now, we have good evidence for this. The idea that October was nothing more than some sort of conspiratorial coup simply won't stand up. To recognize this, you have only to read the report written before the October Revolution by the then correspondent of the Manchester Guardian, Phillips Price, after several weeks' tour of the Volga provinces. By the way, I know of no other foreign eyewitness with a good knowledge of Russia and fluency in the Russian language who made such a tour in the Russian heartland at that time. He wrote, and I quote, "The maximalist fanatics who still dream of a social revolution throughout all Europe have, according to my observations in the provinces, recently acquired an immense, if amorphous, following." By the time this article, filed from somewhere down the Volga, had reached Manchester, the Bolsheviks had taken power. And so the paper published it in December 1917 under the headline, "How the Maximalists Have Come to Gain Control." But it had actually been written before the revolution. But of course, questions about alternatives can't be settled in this way. For instance, what might have happened if the Bolsheviks had not decided to take over, or had been willing to take over at the head of a broad coalition with the other socialist and social revolutionary parties? But how could we know? Phillips Price, for instance, in the very same dispatch, thought it possible that the enormous hatred of the war, which was, he thought, what held together what he called the confused social mass of revolution, would produce, and I quote him again, a Napoleon, a peace dictator, who will put an end to the war even at the cost of territorial losses to Russia and at the price of the political liberties won by the revolution. End quote. Well, we know that something like this did happen. Looking back, we can also see that in the situation of 1917, he was certainly right in supposing that one way or another, Russia would inevitably get out of the war soon. But he also thought that once that happened, the revolution would break up into its struggling class and other fractions, and that this would lead to its defeat. Well, we know that this did not happen. But to a pretty good contemporary observer, it also looked quite likely. As it didn't happen, even we historians can't do more than go on speculating about it. This really is the problem that we face. But how exactly do we speculate? And what is the point of at least some such speculations? The trouble is, there are at least three different kinds of counterfactuals. One kind, though fascinating, is analytically useless. Take the personal role of Lenin, or for that matter Stalin. Without the personal input of these single men, the history of the Russian Revolution would certainly have been very different. In spite of a lot of general political and ideological waffle, individuals do not always make all that much difference in history. For instance, the USA has actually lost 7, possibly 8 presidents before the end of their term by assassination or otherwise since 1865, but seeing in the centrist perspective, it doesn't seem to have made a lot of difference to the shape of American history. On the other hand, sometimes they do, as obviously in the case of Lenin and Stalin, or for that matter, in the last years of the USSR. The former director of the CIA told Fred Halliday here a little while ago, I quote, "I believe that if Andropov had been 15 years younger when he took power in 1982, we would still have a Soviet Union with us, continuing to decline economically, increasingly disadvantaged technically, but still extant." I don't like to agree with CIA chiefs, but this seems to me to be an entirely plausible statement. But having said that, there's not much else to say. You can analyze the kind of historic situations in which single persons can make such a dramatic difference, positively or negatively. Possibly, as Alan Bullock does in his book on parallel lives of Hitler and Stalin, we can investigate the ways in which they then arranged to reinforce their personal power, as Stalin certainly did, though actually Lenin made no such attempt to turn himself into an uncontrollable autocrat. We can establish the limits of what such individuals with absolute domestic power could achieve, or in what way their aims and policies were not specific to themselves as individuals, but characteristic of their time, place, and situation. For instance, you can argue quite plausibly that there was room for more or less harshness in the project of very rapid industrialization by Soviet state planning. But if the USSR was committed to such a project, then it was going to require a good deal of coercion, even if the USSR had been led by someone less utterly ruthless, less cruel than Stalin. Again, you can argue with Professor Moshe Levin of Philadelphia that even total power could not give Stalin control over the ever-swelling bureaucratic machine into which the USSR necessarily turned. Only terror, Only the fear of death for temporarily all-powerful functionaries, he argues, could guarantee that they obeyed the autocrat and did not enmesh him into the indestructible bureaucratic spider web into which later on in the days of Brezhnev and so on, quite clearly the Soviet Union fell. Could be. Or again, you can show that, given a particular historical background, even what autocrats do follows old patterns. Both Stalin and Mao knew that they were the heirs of Tsar and Chinese Emperor, and acted accordingly. At least they knew that that is the way that ordinary Russians and Chinese would see them. But when you say all that, and more, you have still not answered the question about historical alternatives. All you said is, things could have been different if Lenin had been unable to get out of Switzerland till 1918. Or at most, things could have been very different. Or, things might not have been very different. And you can't get any further except into fiction. A second set of counterfactuals are a bit more interesting, if only because they do help the history of the revolution to take off the blinkers of ideological polemic. Let's take the fall of Tsarism. No serious observer, even before 1900, expected Tsarism to survive far into the 20th century. A Russian revolution was universally expected and predicted. Marx himself, in 1879, looked, and I quote, "for a great and not distant crash in Russia, thinks it will begin by reform from above, which the old bad edifice will not be able to bear, and which will lead to its tumbling down altogether." The British politician who reported these views from the Devonshire Club to the daughter of Queen Victoria thought that this view was, I quote, "not unreasonable." Now, in other words, there was no difference. Nobody believed that Tsarism was up and running. In retrospect, it seems pretty undeniable that the chances of Tsarism after surviving its first revolution in 1905 were small, and they were virtually dead well before the Great War, and not very many people thought otherwise except for a moment or two. We need not bother seriously about the theory that Tsarist Russia was well on the way to becoming a prosperous liberal capitalist society when World War I and the Bolsheviks just out of the blue came and ruined it all. But for the requirements of anti-Marxist argument, it would never have been taken seriously. By the way, not even liberals have argued with any confidence that a liberal democratic parliamentary Russia was much of a possibility after the fall of the Tsar. Many of them would like to believe that it was nothing but a Leninist putsch which cut the throat of a promising Russian liberal democracy, but they do so without conviction. I may just remind you, in passing, that in the only reasonably free elections held just after the October Revolution, those for the Constituent Assembly, the bourgeois liberal party scored 5% and the Mensheviks 3%. On the other hand, the communists also have their if-only myth. My own generation, for instance, was brought up on the story of the betrayal of the German Revolution of 1918 by the moderate social democratic leaders. These people aborted the potentially socialist and proletarian German Revolution, Soviet Russia remained isolated, and the logical development hoped for by Marx and Engels didn't happen. Namely, a Russian revolution sparking off a proletarian revolution in countries less obviously unprepared to build a socialist economy.
Now, there is an obvious difference between this and the liberalized tsarism myth. No realistic observer before 1917 expected for more than a moment that tsarism would survive, let alone overcome its problems. But in 1917 to 18, the Marx-Engels scenario did seem very much on the cards. I don't blame German and Russian revolutionaries in that period for having these hopes, although I've argued elsewhere in my book that Lenin should have known better by 1920. For a few weeks in 1918 into 19, a spread of the Russian Revolution to Germany could seem on the cards. But it wasn't. I think today there is a historical consensus about this. World War I profoundly shook all the peoples involved in it, and the revolutions of 1917-18 were, above all, revolts against that unprecedented Holocaust, especially in the countries on the losing side. But in parts of Europe, and nowhere more so than in Russia, they were more than this. They were social revolutions, rejections of the state, the ruling classes, and the status quo by the poor. And I don't think Germany belonged to that revolutionary sector of Europe. I don't think a social revolution in Germany had looked in the least likely in 1913. Unlike the Tsar, I do believe that but for the war, the Kaiser's Germany could have solved its political problems. This doesn't mean that the war was an unexpected and avoidable accident, but that's another question to which I don't want to go. Of course, the moderate social democratic leaders wanted to stop the German Revolution falling into the hands of the revolutionary socialists, let alone the Bolsheviks, because they themselves were neither socialists nor revolutionaries. In fact, they hadn't even wanted to get rid of the emperor. But that is not the point. A German October Revolution or anything like it was, in my view, not seriously on, and therefore it didn't have to be betrayed. I think Lenin was mistaken in putting his money on a German revolution, but I don't think Lenin could have seen this in 1917 or 1918. It just didn't look like that. Now this is where historical retrospection differs from the contemporary assessment of possibilities. If we are in politics to make decisions, as Lenin was, we play them as we see them, and it was natural of him to see them that way. But we know that the past has happened. The match can't be replayed. Therefore, we know that a large number of the possibilities are not there. The Russian Revolution was destined to build socialism in one backward and soon utterly ruined country, although I remain to be convinced by Orlando Figes, who argues that in 1918 Lenin had already given up thinking of a revolution spreading elsewhere in Europe. On the contrary, I suspect that the archives will show that for several more years the Soviet leadership, though not prepared to jeopardize its home base in Russia, remained as committed to international revolution as Fidel Castro and Che Guevara did, and, if I may say so, often with as many illusions and as much ignorance about what was happening outside as Fidel and Che. If you want to discover this, read the most recent New Left Review with an article by Richard Gott on Che Guevara's excursion to the Congo in the very area in which at present the revolt is taking place. Now, I'm inclined to think
that Lenin would have wanted to storm the Winter Palace regardless, even if he had been certain the Bolsheviks would be defeated. I think he might have done so on what might be called by the Irish the Easter Rising principle, that you can do it to provide inspiration for the future, to create martyrs, to create precedent. Still, taking power and declaring a socialist program made sense only if the Bolsheviks looked to a European revolution, and of course, as Lenin was not crazy ideologue like Patrick Pearce, he actually thought constantly about how the damn thing could keep power. It did matter to him whether it lasted or not. Nobody believed that Russia could do it on its own at that time. So, should the October Revolution have been made at all? And if so, with what objects? This brings us to the third type of counterfactuals, which actually deal with the alternatives considered possible at that time. Actually, the question in 1917 was not whether someone else should take over from the provisional government of Kerensky. This was already dead. The question wasn't even who should take over, because the Bolsheviks were the only ones in a position to, either alone or in partnership with an alliance of other people on the left. The discussion at the time was how, whether they should take over with or without a planned insurrection, before, during, or after the forthcoming Congress of Soviets, with what object, allied with whom, and so on. And the basic background to it all is that you had no idea whether a Bolshevik government, or indeed any central Russian government, could survive. Now, on all these arguments, on all these issues, there were real arguments at the time. And not only between Bolsheviks and others, but, as we know, among Bolsheviks themselves, between Lenin and Zinoviev and Kamenev and a number of others. Now, here again, we must ask ourselves, at least I ask myself, a historian. If we now, as historians, say, think that Kamenev was right against Lenin, Kamenev didn't want an October Revolution, we are not actually assessing the chances of Kamenev convincing the Bolshevik party in October 1917, which I would have thought were very, very small. But what we are saying is, if we found ourselves in such a situation today, we should probably take this view. We're talking about a football match now, or a football match, if you like, in the future, not about the match in 1917, whose score cannot be changed anymore. And again, what exactly are we saying if we decide in retrospect? Let's say that it would have been better if the Bolsheviks had not committed themselves to, in effect, single-party government. Are we suggesting that a coalition government would actually have been better at dealing with the desperate situation in Russia then or in the long run, if there had been a long run? Personally, this strikes me as excessively unlikely. Or are we really saying we would have preferred a democratic Russia to emerge from the revolution? Many of us would have done. But that is a statement about our political ideas and not about history. History must start from what happened, and the rest is speculation. But at this stage, we must leave speculation and return to the actual situation of a Russia in revolution. Great mass revolutions erupting from below. And Russia in 1917 was probably the most awesome example of such a revolution in history. These revolutions are, in some sense, natural phenomena. They're like earthquakes, tornadoes, giant floods, especially when, as in Russia, the superstructure of state and national institution is virtually disintegrated. What had happened after the February Revolution is, for practical purposes, there was no effective Russian government. Each little village, each factory, each place had, as it were, established its autonomous control. It ran itself as best it could, and for a while there was, as it were, an uncertainty about everything. As a matter of fact, Phillips Price, whom I quoted before, thought that that probably was the best way they could have managed to avoid for a month or two famine and other things, because they dealt with it. But nevertheless, for practical purposes, there was nothing, there was no effective Russian state. So, to a large extent, such mass revolutions are uncontrollable, and from the days of the French Revolution, when people started to analyze the French Revolution, even in 1793-94, people recognized that this is a characteristic of these extraordinary phenomena. So we've got to stop thinking of the Russian Revolution in terms of the Bolsheviks or anyone else's aims and intentions, their long-term strategy, or other Marxists' critiques of their practice. They were not in a position to carry out directly. They couldn't plan. It's perfectly true that both the orthodox conventional history of Soviet history and the orthodox anti-communist history of the Cold War assumed that the revolution was something that was controlled from above. But the fact is, it wasn't. Why, in fact, did the Soviet government not collapse or go down to defeat, which it could very easily have done? Initially, the new regime had no power at all, certainly no significant armed power. The only real asset the new Soviet government had outside Petrograd and Moscow was their ability to say what the Russian people wanted to hear, and to this extent to acquire the belief that they were a government who spoke for the Russians. What Lenin aimed at was irrelevant. Perfectly true that in the last analysis Lenin could get his way in the party, but nevertheless it is irrelevant. I wrote in my history he could have no strategy or perspective beyond choosing day by day between the decisions needed for immediate survival and the ones which risked immediate disaster. Who could afford to consider the possible long-term consequence for the revolution of decisions which had to be taken now, or else there would be an end to the revolution and no further consequences to consider? Nothing, you see, was predetermined. Any time things could go wrong. Not until 1921 could the regime count on being permanent, could take stock of the appalling state to which Russia had been reduced, and to begin to think in terms of years rather than months or even weeks. But by this time, its future course was more or less prescribed, and it was a long, long way from anything any Marxist, including Lenin, had envisaged for Russia before the revolution. So, how did the October Revolution come to survive? First, and here I agree very much with Orlando Figes' new book on the Russian Revolution, A People's Tragedy, it won because it fought under the red flag and, however misleadingly, in the name of the Soviets. People wanted to fight under the Soviets. They believed that was the right thing. In the last analysis, the Russian peasants and workers preferred the Reds against the Whites, who would, they thought, take away the land and bring back the Tsar, the gentry, and the bourgeois. And remember, Fidges reminds us that all the white armies, though they were stuffed full of monarchists, none of them dared promise a restoration of the Tsar. They knew that politically this was a kiss of death. The Russians did not want to get back to where they'd been. The Bolsheviks, they were believed to stand for the revolution which most Russians had wanted. And remember, the Russian Revolution was made by the masses, and for its first 10 years its fate was determined by the Russian masses, not necessarily by what they wanted, but by what they couldn't stand for. That is why Lenin decided to do a U-turn after the Civil War, because the workers wouldn't stand for what they were doing it, Kronstadt rising, and the peasants wouldn't stand for it. The mass rising against the Bolsheviks, they hadn't been mass rising while the Civil War was on, but afterwards they were mass rising. And Lenin knew there was no way of bucking it. The Soviets were not in a position to do it. That was a situation for the first year the revolution. Stalin put an end to this situation. Second, they won because, and this is a point which isn't often recognized, they were the only potential force of national government after the Tsar. The alternative in 1917 was not and could not be whether Russia should be democratic or dictatorial, but whether there should be a Russian state or whether it should break up. Here, the controlled Leninist centralist structure of the Bolshevik Party, which is an institution as it were designed for disciplined action and therefore de facto for state building, was essential. Although it built a state, I think we must admit, at a greater cost to freedom than under Tsarism. But if not the Bolsheviks, then in fact, one of the few achievements of the Russian Revolution, which not even its enemies deny, is that unlike the other defeated multinational empires of World War I, the Habsburgs and the Turkish Ottoman Empire, Russia was not broken into pieces. The October Revolution maintained it for another three quarters of a century as a great bicontinental multinational state, and indeed helped it reacquire a good deal of the country's loss. You compare both the Turkish and the Habsburg empires with very similar structures with Russia, this is important. Now, we consistently underestimate the appeal which the Soviet government therefore had to non-political, even to right-wing patriotic Russians, both during and after the Civil War. I'm incidentally thinking of the curious return of a small but influential number of Russian émigrés, civilians and even military, in the five-year plan period under Stalin, you know, in around about 1930. They said, "This, we didn't want this, but this is Russia, this has, Russia remains great and important because of these people, and even though we would prefer something else, this is it." But third, they won because the Bolsheviks had an appeal which was not purely Russian. Their foreign policy the foreign powers may have been half-hearted in their support of the various and mutually hostile white armies in civil war for various reasons. But after the end of World War I, they knew that they could not have sent major forces on their own to carry on the war, least of all against a regime which was identified everywhere, in Britain, in Germany, in France, everywhere, with the workers' revolution. The Bolsheviks recovered control of most of the Russian Caucasian territories, because they were seen as an anti-imperialist force and therefore an anti-imperialist revolution, the Turkish Revolution, was prepared to deal with them. we underestimate, it seems to me, the advantages which the international situation gave them, which allowed them, in a sense, gave them more room for maneuver, more room for immediate recovery than they had. But this international impact of October brings me to my last point, which will also be my conclusion. The Russian Revolution really has two interwoven histories: its impact on Russia and its impact on the world. We mustn't confuse the two, even though they can't be separated. Without the second, few except a handful of specialist historians would ever have been concerned with Russian history. Outside the USA, not many people know more about the American Civil War than that Gone with the Wind is about it. And yet, the American Civil War was both the greatest war between 1815 and 1914, and by far the greatest in American history. They lost more in the American Civil War than in all the other wars, including World War I and II, put together. And it can also claim to have been something like a second American Revolution. It meant, and it means, an enormous amount in the USA, but very little outside, because the other countries were not very much affected by what happened in America in the Civil War. Now, both in Russian history and in 20th century world history, the Russian Revolution is a towering phenomenon. There's no way for in any country in getting around it. But it is not the same kind of phenomenon. What does it mean for Russia? Well, of course, it means that it means a peak of Russian international power and prestige in history. And like it or not, Stalin will go down with Peter the Great, and probably, you know, as in future, just in the same way that whatever you may think of the pros and cons of what happened in Cuba since 1959, Fidel Castro will be the most important figure in Cuban history books for the foreseeable future, for the next few centuries at least. So, but that doesn't really tell you what it did to the Russian people. Well, its achievements were titanic. Among others, we benefited by them because they defeated 85% of the German army, and without them it wouldn't be defeated. But the human cost of these achievements, the building up of an industrial state, the building up of a backward country into some kind of modernity, was enormous. Its dead-end economy was destined to run down. Its political system broke down. For most of its inhabitants who can remember, it's probably true that the old Soviet era looks far better than what the former Soviet peoples are going through now, and will go on doing so for a long while. But it is too early to draw up a historical balance sheet. I mean, we can argue about it, but I don't think the point has come when the argument can be, any kind of consensus can be done. As for the various socialist and formerly socialist peoples, we must let them come to their own judgment on the impact of the revolution on their history. I haven't time to go into it, although it's quite clear that it will be very varied. The impact, for instance, in the German Democratic Republic, the former German Democratic Republic, will probably end up being negative. The impact in Yugoslavia and most of the Balkans will probably, in my view, mean that they passed through the best age in their history under communism. But we must leave that to somebody else. As for the rest of the world, we only knew the Russian Revolution and Soviet Union at second hand. We knew it as a force for liberation in the former colonial world and in all Europe before and during World War II. We knew it as the quintessential enemy for the USA and indeed for all conservative and capitalist regimes for most of the century, except between 1933 and 1945. And for the left in the industrial world from the 1930s on, we knew it as something which frightened the rich into giving some political priority to the concerns of the poor. But the terrible paradox of the Soviet era is that the Stalin experienced by the Soviet people and the Stalin seen as a liberating force outside were the same. And he was the liberator for the ones, to some extent at least, because he was a tyrant for the others. Can historians ever come to an agreed consensus about such a figure and such a phenomenon? I mean, shall we say, can they come to a formula which will bring into one common denominator the what happened in Russia, which on the whole was a drama, a tremendous drama which ended in failure, and the impact of the October Revolution and of the existence of the Soviet Union elsewhere? I don't honestly see how they can for the foreseeable future. And to this extent, I think there will be room for a debate on the Russian Revolution for a very, very long time to come, and probably the lifetime of everybody in this hall. Thank you very much.
Very much indeed, Eric. There's now the possibility of a brief period of questions and extremely brief contributions. So please put up your hand, anybody who'd like to avail themselves of this. At the back.
Thank you. My name is Don Edwards. It's been a great pleasure to listen to the professor. I've just got one very simple thing to ask. Why did he only mention Trotsky once in the introduction to the Isaac Deutscher Memorial Lecture? He didn't mention him at all right the way through his lecture. I think he was a very important figure, and yet he wasn't even mentioned.
Do you want to reply in groups?
In groups.
Yeah, okay. Next one, please. Sir, yes, at the front.
In regard to, we've all read your work, and you and I once had a short correspondence. I'm Professor Jaffe from South Africa. Two questions, which are really one, I think. Russian Revolution, what has happened now, I mean? Or was it due to a victory for capitalist imperialism? Over a long period of time, in 1,001 ways, going for that system, including one very hot war, by the way, the Nazi invasion. So was it the failure of communism or the robustness of the capitalist system because of its colonial basis being international? That is number one. Then my second question follows from that.
Well, please, very quickly, please.
Yeah, very
quick. Could you speak up just a little?
In 1900, historians gave Zorism no chance at all. And I think we would agree with that assessment. In 2000, 100 years later, what chance do you give, or can we give, capitalism in Russia today, which you described as a catastrophe?
Thank you. Next question, please. The show up in the gallery, yes?
Yes, sorry. Stalin, the liberator of peoples, this is the 40th anniversary almost of the week or the month of the Hungarian Revolution of 1956. Perhaps you could comment on the relationship between those two events.
Go
guy in the front.
I'd like to just answer a question. I think you have a very important impact beyond the academic sphere, very important politically. And I mean, in an interview in 1990, you asked, was Russia ever a socialist country? And I quote, this is what I said. It obviously wasn't a worker state. Nobody in the Soviet Union ever believed it was a worker state. And the workers knew it wasn't a worker state. What do you think Russia was? Was it communist? Was it state capitalist, as Tony Clifford said? Well, what do you believe Russia was? And also, following on from that implications, what do you think are the prospects for the for the fight for socialism in the future?
Do you want to start with that group here?
Okay.
Maybe I can manage. As I mentioned, Deutsch's Life of Trotsky as a masterpiece of the history of the Soviet Union, you can't say that I was particularly aiming not to pay adequate attention to Trotsky. There are a lot of things that I didn't mention in this, but certainly I was not particularly intending either to do down Trotsky or to enter into the great discussions about him which still go on. Second, Hosea Jaffe's. Was it a failure of communism? I've tried to explain my position on this in my book on the Age of Extremes, so I shan't say very much about it. I think that there was no way in which starting in the Soviet Union and remaining for 20 years in the Soviet Union, you could build proper socialism. I agree, looking back, with old Plekhanov, the father of Russian Marxism, who said, if you do that, the best you can do is a red version of the old Chinese Empire. I think in a sense, if you look back historically, it would have been better if they tried to do something else. But as I've tried to show in my lecture, it's ridiculous to say they should have done something else, because, I mean, what happened, happened. And you can only talk about historical alternatives if the people at the time thought there was an alternative and it took what some people at least knew was the wrong road, but if there was a chance of them having gone the other way. The future of capitalism in Russia, very difficult to see. It seems to me that Russia is, well, I've said this before in other contexts, been three major breakdowns in Central and Eastern Europe during this century. After World War I, after World War II, both of which had enormous destructive capacity, and after 1989. And of the three, this one today is the least manageable and the one which is likely to last longest. To give you an example, by 1926 or thereabouts, the people in Russia, after about 5 years of new economic policy, reckoned that Russia was more or less back where it had been in 1913, which wasn't saying much, but still. By 1950, the Soviet Union was back where it had been in 1939, in spite of dramatic, terrible destruction. Today, 6-7 years after, the Soviet and the ex-Soviet economies are still going down. And even where they're going up, as in some of the other countries, they have not got back to where they were again in 1988. The disruption is much greater. I believe that the chances of getting a flourishing capitalism in Russia I'm pretty pessimistic about this. They're probably not bad in some of the smaller countries like Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, possibly Hungary. I think what happens in Russia is likely to be, first of all, it would be exploited both by local racketeers and by foreigners. It has been reduced back to a third world country to some extent. It has lost an enormous amount of its infrastructure, of its capacity, even of its manpower. One of the great positive achievements of George Soros, for instance, who was an ex-LSE man, is that in giving away money to these East Europeans, particularly to Russia, he gave away money to Russian scientists on condition that they stayed in Russia, that they didn't go elsewhere. The future, a lot of the future of this great country, which is incredibly talented people, has been really put at very considerable risk in the past few years. I think what is likely is something like what happened, say, in the south of Italy, which was integrated into a world capitalist economy without the adequate infrastructure and the adequate social preparations. In Sicily, you've got a lot of money, you've got an enormous amount of social inequality, but you don't have a flourishing capitalism. You've got a gangster economy. And this is what's very likely to be happening, except insofar as you have an economy of foreign gangsters rather than domestic gangsters. But we simply do not know what is going to happen because the disruption has been so dramatic in that particular area. Stalin liberated the peoples. I did not say that Stalin wanted to liberate anybody. On the contrary, the point about Stalin is that he was an appalling tyrant. Incidentally, you can't make Stalin responsible for 1956 because you'd be dead by that time. The Soviet regime, quite clearly, until the days of Gorbachev, preferred, when in doubt, to use the big stick. No question. But nevertheless, Stalin and the Soviet Union were in places like Italy. The people in Italy who looked to Stalin. I remember during the last war in the British Army, people thought of Stalin as somebody who was helping us defeat Hitler. And he was, by the very fact that he was there, that the Soviet Union, the Red Army, was fighting and tearing the heart out of it. This is exactly the terrible paradox that I tried to finish with, that a regime against which a lot not only can be said, but must be said, even if we accept the enormous achievements which it did make, that this regime actually outside its borders had a different effect. If by any chance we had been occupied by the Russians, by the Red Army, we wouldn't be talking about this way, but because we would have seen a different side of the Red Army. I don't know how to get, this is why I say the argument will go on and must go on. Was the USSR a worker state or a state capitalist? I don't like to go into these semantic questions about how do we classify it. It was certainly a state which was based on the complete socialization or state property of the means of production. To that extent, I suppose you would have to call it in traditional terms a kind of socialist state. It wasn't a worker state, although, if I may say so, we underestimate the extent to which, in actual fact, even in the Soviet Union, it had to come to terms with the workers. Because for most of the time, the Soviet Union, even though it didn't have any effective unions, was operating with a position of labor shortage. A labor shortage, some of it could be solved by Stalin by sending people to gulags, but not all of it could. So to this extent, it wasn't a worker state, but it took a good deal more account of the workers than the present regime in Russia does. This is the same thing. So
The other thing that I think we must say is that it was socialist to the extent that it believed to a degree in a degree of equality and egalitarianism, which is very hard for us to imagine. Orlando Figes points out that this was a great Russian tradition, the belief that it is bad for some people to be better off than the others. People resented the corruption of the rich, but by our standards, the corruption even of the leading people in the Soviet Union, there weren't that many of them, was chicken feed compared to the difference in wealth, in the public displays of wealth that we find in other countries. Still, that's it, but I don't think that we should go around arguing about what to call it. I don't even think we should defend it, but we should recognize that it was in its own way a working society, and that what has been destroyed now by something which is at least as radical as what the Bolsheviks tried to do between 1928 and 1932 is a complete destruction of everything that made the society in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe work. It didn't work all that well. Towards the end it required a fair amount of palm greasing and this and that to operate, but it operated. And with people like Jeffrey Sachs and all the others coming and saying, no solution, you've got to tear it all down and let the market do it, it stopped operating. It became, in fact, what the left always, what the right always claimed it was, namely an economic ruin. It was very inefficient and it was a very, very dodgy and not clumsy economy, but it wasn't a non-economy. And for a while it became a non-economy and a non-society. As you can see now, I doubt whether it happened in the Soviet Union that workers could go on working without being paid for 6 months. So how the devil they managed to keep going, presumably they get advances, you know, because I don't know how. But it's a mess.
We'll take perhaps a couple more questions. Yes, Michael Scott.
The Soviet Union looked like a very monochrome society for many years, but I feel it contained elements of a civil society that was in some measure independent and had a fair amount of continuity with the past, whether academic life, the churches, even the memories of grandmothers. Do you see it part of the task of historians to excavate this and evaluate it?
Well, I mean, the Russians are excavating it, and suppose historians are not excavating it, but you're perfectly correct. You see, we've all learned over here to think of this as it were not a real society, but something imposed, totalitarian, this, this total state. Well, of course, there was a lot of that. But in actual fact, what was going on underneath the surface, an enormous amount had to go on, because otherwise, actually, real society wouldn't have worked. I mean, to take the obvious example, the planned industrialization made virtually no provision whatever for the kind of little services and repairs and maintenance and so on, without which, as we all know, life can't go on. Does it mean that for 70 years none of this was done in the Soviet Union? Of course not. It was done as it were, but not officially recognized. It was done in various ways. And I think if the historians of the future, the social historians, will have to see exactly how this happened. To what extent, in a sense, elements of what in the West people call civil society, actually I wish we'd give a moratorium on the use of this particular phrase for a while, but a lot was going on that was not the state, that wasn't planned, that was, even if it's only, for instance, groups of friendship. The role of friendship and personal relations in the Soviet period was enormous, far greater than over here. The inheritance is you're quite right. We find, for instance, I mean, every one of us here who knows Russian knows. Isaiah Berlin keeps telling me, he says, I thought the Soviets had completely destroyed the old intelligentsia, and then I discovered it was still there. The same people who's, I mean, I know people who are, whatever it is, Orientalists, whose fathers were professors of Orientalism, whose grandfathers were, and probably whose great-grandfathers in the days of the Tsar. This extraordinary, this bit, this is a thing which historians will have to go on doing, and will, of course, do. But this is merely saying that we're beginning to look at the Soviet, at the history of the Soviet Union, as we look at the history of any other country. We shall still have to go on arguing about it with a degree of passion which other countries don't necessarily have.
We haven't had a single woman questioner yet. Still one? No? No? Yes. Please.
Well, who won the Cold War? I mean, it's fairly clear that the Soviet Union lost the Cold War. It isn't there anymore, so to this extent. Except that, in a sense, it has suffered after the end of the Cold War, as it has suffered worse than if than most other countries have suffered after they lost a hot war. I think the argument about the Cold War isn't about who won or who lost, but whether in fact the Soviet Union fell because of the efforts of the other side. I don't think they did. I think everybody was used, the Americans, and everybody was geared to going on for a very long time. They didn't believe that it was going to collapse, and they didn't indeed, they weren't prepared to recognize that the Soviet Union had changed until quite late in the 80s. I think they went down for two, possibly three reasons. First of all, because it was very clear from the 1960s on that their economy wasn't working properly. And they were desperately trying to get it to work in all the socialist states in Europe by much the same way, namely by trying to introduce elements of the market into an extremely rigid, too rigid system, and to introduce some kind of local dynamism into it. Secondly, because in the course of this, they did get themselves involved increasingly in the world economy with which they were unfamiliar and for which they were not geared. In a sense, from the moment that the Russians, instead of doing anything basic about their agriculture, started buying wheat on the world market, that was the beginning of the end. And third, they could do this because of the appalling good luck they had by briefly becoming oil billionaires. In fact, the enormous new oil fields and natural gas fields and other things, which very largely developed, discovered in the 1960s and then developed, made the Soviet Union into one of the major beneficiaries of the oil price rise in the early and again in the later 70s. And they didn't know how to handle it. And indeed, on the contrary, it gave people like Brezhnev and his advisors megalomania. They thought they could compete with the Americans. They thought they could become
this for the only time when I think there is a case to be made for saying the Soviet Union behaved as though it might have been expansionist was in the 70s, on the strength of all that money with which they thought they could, as it were, defeat or run a race with the Americans in missiles. It was a lunatic arrangement. The balance, the nuclear balance, did not depend on either side having more missiles than the other side. It depended on each side knowing that the other side had enough missiles to make a hot war suicidal. McNamara told Kennedy that this was already the case in 1962, in the time of the Cuba crisis, when the Soviet says they've got enough missiles to cause us really terrible, terrible harm. So in a balance. The idea of building up the Soviet Union to an equality, which they never could have done anyway, but even an equality in missile launchers, was suicidal. What with all these three things is, if anything, it was the Soviets that ruined themselves, particularly in the 70s, which I believe will turn out to be the disaster period in the history of the Soviet Union.
Well, I'm afraid that that will have to be the last of the questions, but it certainly won't be the last of the discussion, which Eric Hobsbawm's talk and answers to questions this evening will have stimulated, and which I think we should express our appreciation for.